Please be advised this podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature. It's not appropriate for children.
To make money to line your pocket on my daughter's murder!
A mother's grief, as raw as it gets.
You should have contacted me and told me what had happened.
Our cameras are rolling as Sonia Anderson confronts a psychiatrist she accuses of profiting from her daughter's murder in his new book, Killer Instinct. Her family's never been told her final words until now.
I read in your book that my daughter wanted to say goodbye to her son, and I didn't know that until you wrote it. You didn't tell me what my daughter's dying words were!
In 2010, Bianca Gervin was strangled by her crazed boyfriend, who was interviewed by Donald Grant in hospital, Sonia interrupting his book launch in West End, sparking this mass walkout.
And you, the psychiatrist, are the one and only person that has caused me and my family deliberate distress.
Dr. Grant is the state's former head of forensic psychiatry. This afternoon, the doctor calling a press conference to set the record straight.
I believe families deserve insight into why their loved ones were killed. Families of victims should have access to expert reports.
Queensland Health is now investigating the publication of this book, which it says appears to be a betrayal of victims, patients and their families. Police sources have also told me it's riddled with factual errors.
Sam Cucciara, Nine News.
This is kind of a nightmare scenario for those of us who make and consume media in the true crime genre. At what point are we crossing the line into exploitation of victims and their families?
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb.
I'm on record as saying that I think true crime is valuable because we can learn a lot from it about our cultural systems and how they're travelling. When we take the time to delve beyond the headlines into the backgrounds of perpetrators and victims and how they came to cross paths, we can often see disturbing inadequacies in our education system, our mental health system, our family court system, our parole system, and in the messages we teach our children. In recent times, we've come to understand the reality of domestic violence in a way we never had before. Today, when someone asks, "Why didn't she just leave?" they'll likely be shouted down by the majority of Australians who are much better informed about the realities of people in violent relationships. We now know that the most dangerous time for a person in such a relationship is the 3 months after they leave. That is when they're most likely to be murdered. I would argue that while that information was readily available, it didn't sink in until the true crime genre exposed it to the mainstream as fact. So, while I have made peace with my personal fascination with true crime, the possibility of getting it wrong, to the point of being confronted by the devastated mother of a murder victim, haunts me. Sonia Anderson is the mother who recently made headlines by confronting the psychiatrist who wrote about the murder of her daughter, Bianca. In particular, this man talked about her daughter's dying words. They were words that Sonia had never heard before. Sonia agreed to speak to me about the line between reportage and exploitation.
It's actually been, shockingly for me, really quite debilitating because I'm a strong person.
Yeah.
But far out, you know, to have somebody to do what he did just came out of nowhere. So, but anyway, I'm getting better every single day. That's the good news.
Yeah. I just read this morning again your media release, and it did sort of, in all of everything that I was reading about you and stuff and getting ready for this, I forgot about that. I forgot about how you would have worked through or tried to work through sort of not thinking about the night of your daughter's death every minute of the day, and now this would have brought it back. So Can you tell us a bit about that? About that process?
Yeah, it was very, very difficult. So it was almost all that was in my head for so long, and exceptionally painful, and wondering if she was screaming for me, wanted her mum, wanted Ziggy, her son. There's a story actually in the Weekend Australian a few weekends ago in the Colour magazine. You should get a copy of that one, where I used to, because he strangled her for 10 minutes, I used to try to work out how fast I could have got there to help her had I known he was strangling her. You know, so it replays in your head nonstop, and that's normal for, you know, somebody whose family member's been murdered. But what got me through that was Charmaine Wilson, the medium. I spent time with her, and she explained to me that Bianca is no longer in her moment of death, and nor should I be stuck in her moment of death, that I should be focusing more on her life, and Bianca doesn't, you know, like me there. So it was a really long, journey to get out of it, but I finally did. It would have been more than five and a half years after her death before I finally got out of that horrible moment and decided to let that go.
I think that's a really interesting point. Anyone who's lost someone they love in a traumatic way can become obsessed with that moment, can't they? And to try and remember that that moment is actually over for the person they love is really difficult, because you can live in it forever.
You do, absolutely. Yeah. And I spend a lot of time talking to other mums of murder victims. Mm. And this is one of the areas I try to help people in. When I say those words, I again feel so betrayed that I put so much of my personal time and energy into working with charities or police or public speaking and doing so much work and changing laws and working with the government. I do so much without any pay to do something good and to help other mums, and then to have somebody just come and do this is just unbelievable.
How do you feel about talking to us about Bianca's murder? Would you rather that when it comes time to putting this episode together, I fill in that part of it, or would you rather do it?
I don't know. I can start talking with you, and then we can work out how it comes out.
Absolutely.
Best.
I mean, you tell our listeners as much as you want to, and if anything else needs filling in, I can go back and do that later. So if you would like to tell us about Bianca, you tell us as much as you feel comfortable doing, and I can fill in any gaps later.
Okay. Well, Bianca was exceptionally quirky. And eclectic and creative and funky and hilariously funny and always helped other people. That was one of her big things. Even as a young teenager, her passion was to help homeless women subjected to violence. She was only a young girl. She would talk on the radio just days before she died, on the Saturday before she was killed. She was at Ophilas, and she was sewing a quilt with the group of girls, and it was called Equiltity. She named it Equiltity. It was her name, and it was for the girls at Ophilas and the girls at, I think it's Brisbane Girls Grammar School, were doing this as a joint venture to say everybody's equal.
Now, you reminded me of Ophilas, because I went there when I was working in Brisbane. I visited there a couple of times. It's an organisation where young at risk, I guess, is the term we use, isn't it? Women who are struggling, women who've maybe left school early, women who've had babies young, women can go and hang out and get support, and really also just kind of get a bit of company. And I mean, how would you describe that organisation?
Oh, it was fabulous. Bianca was really part of it there, and she was actually, I found out after she was murdered, and this is another heartbreaking thing, that they were about to offer her. So the week before Bianca was killed, my daughter Bonnie was offered a job at Mica Projects, because my girls all have a good social conscience.
Wow.
And Bianca was thinking, oh, Mom, you know, I don't want to say anything bad, but I really, really wanted that job, and Bonnie got it. And what she didn't get to know, and I found out later, it's because they were giving Bianca a bigger job at Ophilas, a full-time job from memory. Okay. And she never got to know. But her whole passion was to do things for other people and help other people. So
that says everything, doesn't it? That says that she was really committed to helping other people and specifically young women.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's when her death was such a shock in Brisbane for young women, is that these girls all went to Bianca for advice, and she would go there and she'd spend, you know, she'd talk to young women all the time and assist them and do whatever she could. So for her to be the one that was murdered by a partner, I think really made a lot of young women in Queensland feel at risk.
Unbelievable. So had they been in a violent relationship to your knowledge?
This one's really hard. So it's widely reported that Reese had put a knife to Bianca's throat once, I think a few years earlier.
Okay.
Apart from that, I'm aware of nothing else.
Yeah.
But okay. I can say that Bianca knew that he wasn't necessarily always doing the right thing or did need assistance and needed help. Mm-hmm. And she felt that he was being failed by his parents, who were psychologists, who didn't want to alert anybody that Reese was maybe not doing the right thing. So she ended up feeling it was her responsibility to look after him and make sure that he was okay when things went right. So, you know, I look back at that and I guess that's how I brought my children up to be. And, of course, now I look back and think, should I have I wanted my children to care so much about other people. And while I say those words, I can look at my life now and it's what I'm still doing. So, you know, I can't take it back. But, you know, that's just what happens when you care too much. Sometimes, you know, you end up paying the ultimate price, which is what Bianca did.
And Reese was found of unsound mind.
Yes.
After Bianca's death.
Yeah. But it's interesting, though. So there is a difference with it. So he was found of unsound mind.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, if you read what is publicly available, the part that is, which is the judgment at the end of court, he also has egosyntonic symptoms. So that means even if he's mentally well, his own personality, separate to any mental illness, has a desire to murder. Wants the murder, likes the idea, and doesn't see anything wrong with that. So that makes this one even more alarming.
Yeah. That's a terrifying diagnosis, and especially for a mother to hear. So he's in a psychiatric facility rather than a prison, is that right?
He went to a psychiatric facility, yes, but I can't. How good is this? You know, this doctor spreads all this information that can't be shared in public. But all I can tell you is I do get a 6-monthly update as to what, a very vague update as to where Reese is, and I can't share with you that information.
Right.
So I'm doing the right thing. The doctor didn't, but I'm doing the right thing by saying I can't tell you what's happening.
Okay, so that brings us to the most recent situation. You have hit the headlines a couple of weeks ago. You disrupted a book launch in Brisbane, an incredibly brave thing to do because, I mean, in the moment, now everyone, you know, it's almost like now it sort of seems easier, I think, like when we look at you now and you've got the headlines and it all seems very obvious. But in that room, in that moment, it must have taken an extraordinary amount of courage for you to stand up and say, excuse me, everyone, I need to stop what's happening here. Can you talk us through that night?
Wow. So first of all, I can tell you it's taken me a long time to deal with the fact that I got angry in public.
Yeah.
Because I have a very solid sort of boundaries I set for myself, and it's always to act with dignity, and I felt like I let myself down. I've come to terms with that now. Now, on that night, I was sitting there in the audience and just listening to so much horrible crap. I was listening to this doctor saying that every single person, all of us have the instinct and the desire to kill, which is absolutely not correct. I had to listen to him talking about my daughter's murder. I had to listen to him talking about, I'll tell you, there were things he said that I won't repeat because he was talking about horrendous murders from many years ago that I can't believe people would talk about in a crowded room.
So, and also it was a book launch. It was a launch. Dr. Donald Grant was launching his book. So it's a sort of almost a festive atmosphere in which he's the star of the evening. And I've been at my own book launches. So you're the star of the night. Someone's there asking you questions about your book, and you're trying to drum up a bit of publicity. You're trying to get everyone excited about your book, get everyone to buy your book, and then you sign a few copies at the end of the night. So that's what the night's about, and you're sitting there and listening to that sort of stuff happening.
Yeah, and I started shaking really quite uncontrollably. I was struggling to stay quiet because what he was saying, it was just getting worse and worse and worse. And then eventually I stood up, and that's when I was so, so upset, and I let him know that what he did was wrong. You know, he even put in there what were my daughter's apparent final words when she was told she wasn't going to survive before she got strangled for 10 minutes.
So Bianca's story is one of the stories that is highlighted in the book. Did he, as a doctor, was he treating Reese at any time, or how does he know this information?
With the mental health court, they pay psychiatrists to go out to the park. That's where that's the facility he's in or was in. They go out to the park and they interview them, and then they get that information and they pass it on to the mental health court. So the mental health court collects these psychiatric reports, and it's from those that they decide ultimately whether a person is of unsound mind or whether they go to criminal court. The information that goes to a mental health court is kept totally, totally secret, and it's only what the judge puts out at the very end that goes into the public realm.
Right.
So there was a lot of information he obviously got from Reese and decided to put into the book. The other, you know, after I'd calmed down, you know, the bit that everybody sees on television is the bit where, you know, it started. I was still quite distressed, but I spoke sensibly, and I brought up a lot of very valid points, which he was unable to answer. I challenged him on a number of things and he couldn't answer, which was astounding for me. He didn't understand that when he's deemed somebody of unsound mind, that by definition means they cannot then give you consent to print what they've told a psychiatrist into a book. Because when you deem somebody of unsound mind when it comes to killing somebody, it means they didn't have a certain list of capacities. And one of them is obviously the ability to give consent. So I felt like I had to explain his job role to him.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, absolutely. So what was the reaction of everyone in the room? What did he say to you when you explained all of that to him in front of all those people?
Oh, it's hard for me to recall.
Because, yeah, I bet, yeah.
Yeah, hard for me to recall. Where other people challenged him. You know, we had Betty Taylor, and she sits on the Death Review Board in Queensland, and she explained that she has to read and go through the most horrific murders in Queensland on that board, and that nobody would ever even repeat those stories outside that room. It is so private. And she said if anybody ever wanted to write a book on one of those stories, it would have to be the family member. So in my instance, it would have to be, you know, in Bianca's story, it would have to be me. It's not anybody else's right, and it's unethical. And she also did the Woolston Park interviews for Queensland Health, and she handed that report to Queensland Health. As far as she knows, only a handful of people in Australia have ever seen that report, and she will never ever repeat any of what she learned to anybody because she does not have the right, and it's unethical. And she's explaining this to him, and I just don't think he got it.
So you're attempting to have the book pulled from the shelves.
Well, it has to be, you know, ultimately it has to be for apparently we've got the Triple C looking into it. We do have the Health Ombudsman looking into it, the Royal Australian New Zealand College of Psychiatry looking into it. But these wheels turn slowly, as they keep telling me. It's going to be a slow process. So I think ultimately the publisher should do something, but they're not. I've contacted them a couple of times and they're not responding to me. The doctor hasn't contacted me to explain further. They're there just purely to make money. So I think it's up to the people to, A, don't buy the book. The bookshops, please, you know what right is and what wrong is, what's ethical, what's unethical. I think we as Australians know the difference between good and bad. And what he's done is bad. It really is bad. He's put in things that are not in the public realm, things that families don't know, things that are exceptionally painful with no understanding of what he's done. Or if he does understand it, he must be the most unempathetic person I've ever met in my life.
So how and when did you discover that things were in this book? For example, Bianca's last words were in this book and you had not heard that before.
So on Friday the 8th, I received a phone call from Queensland Health Victim Support Service, and their job role is to liaise between mental health and victims' families. And they told me that they heard about the book, they went and got a copy, they read it that morning, read Bianca's chapter and said to me, you know, they were very distressed because they understand what little information we families get. They were very distressed and said that there was, you know, information in there that they weren't aware of, that they know, obviously, I don't know. They had no idea how a psychiatrist could have gotten away with printing such secretive information that we weren't allowed access to. So we decided I'd drive home from work so I could be safe. And they would scan that chapter and email it to me. And then I read it at home. And I read through it very quickly to get it done, and I haven't read it since. And I will have to, obviously, but, you know, it's really put me in a bad, really, really bad black place. And the last 2 weeks since it happened, I didn't go to work for a week and a half, and I haven't been in Brisbane and not gone to my office like this since Bianca was murdered. That's how much it's traumatised me.
Yeah. Would you say you're back in that sort of obsessive place?
Yeah, I'm back in a bad place. I'm back in a really bad place. I'm trying to still continue to do with my positive work for the community, even while this is going on. Yesterday I attended the forum with the Red Rose Foundation. I went to the candle lighting vigil last night for the beautiful young 22-year-old who was murdered in Melbourne. You know, I'm still trying to be there and do the right thing, but it's very hard because I'm finding it's sort of crushing. It's crushing me at the moment. I want to do positive things, but it's just what he's done has affected me so badly. I feel like I'm being crushed. I can't think of a better word for it.
Yeah, I mean, as a person who makes a true crime podcast, what do you see any positivity in what any of us do? Is there any? There are certainly people who say to me and to us that what we're doing is gross as well. Like, do you?
No, I'm not. I think I'm very fair. I think I'm a very fair person in that I'm actually going to the launch, and again, I'm on my best behaviour this week for the teacher's pet because I like the idea where a journalist cares so much and can reopen cold cases. I think that's a wonderful thing. I think if things are already in the public realm with, say, criminal law, which is totally different to mental health law, especially in Queensland, you know, things can be discussed more openly. I think families definitely need to be notified that they might be re-traumatised. Mm. But there's definitely a place for it. Everybody else I'm coming across, and I do speak to a lot of reporters, the ethics, I believe, are really quite high. They've got a high standard. That's what astounds me, that in this instance it was a psychiatrist that didn't have the ethics, you know, who should understand how painful this is for a human being's mind.
Well, I think your courage in coming forward and even in now in fighting through this crushing situation, the darkness that you're feeling, is really just such a great reminder for us of how important it is to remain ethical and to always check and always be so careful and not get lazy and not sort of in the hurry to meet deadlines to forget these things, you know. So, I'm sure we all just really appreciate your standing up and being counted and not in that moment sort of just crumbling, which none of us would have blamed you for doing.
Yeah, sometimes I think that laying in the fetal position in my bed looks really, really inviting. Mm. But I think I get handed these things because I don't want to see this happening to somebody else. I always think of the bigger picture, and it's not necessarily about me. I always look at how it affects others and what I can do that can be better.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is another one of them. And yeah, it causes me great pain. He's caused me great pain. This book has caused me great pain. But fighting it hurts me. But I really think something good can come out of this. It's worth fighting that fight.
Yeah, it definitely is. What is your self-care system? Do you have counselling? Do you go to counselling? What's your support system?
Just friends, I guess, and hugging my grandchildren.
Yeah.
I did spend a lot of time getting grief counselling, but I've stopped that. Charmaine Wilson, the medium, is actually, if I need anything, I'll message her, and she's always so wonderful, and she messages me back and we discuss it. But really, I rely on friends saying something nice to me, or ultimately hugging my grandchildren, especially, you know, Bianca's son. I'm so distressed about how he's going to be when he understands what has been written in this book. You know, and the effect it will have. It's very thoughtless, very careless. Such a lovely little boy, you know, such a beautiful little boy. And if his story wasn't hard enough already, for somebody to add this to it, I think was just really, really nasty.
Yes, it does feel like a very cruel blow to a family that's had enough cruelty already.
Yeah.
But I'm always loath to sort of criticise other people because I know I make mistakes too, and I always think maybe it's just a terrible mistake, maybe a good person made a terrible mistake, but it would be fantastic if they could contact you and apologise and do everything they could do to make it right for you, I guess, is what we would hope for now.
We would hope so, but I understand they've got their lawyers already. They're not contacting me. They're still spinning the sales, you know. They're seeing it as money. It's very disappointing. Very, very disappointing. Yeah, I'd like to think that the rest of Australia is full of good people and wouldn't agree with what's happening here.
Sonia, do you have a Facebook page or anywhere else that you would like anyone to show support for you, or is there anything?
Yes. We're going to do an online petition starting today, actually.
Okay.
So the Queensland Homicide Victims Support Group will be starting that.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to do a petition on, is it change.org? It should be coming out, I'm thinking, in the next few hours. And absolutely, we would like everybody to get on board and show that this is not acceptable. This is not how we treat people. We're better than this.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Please take care of yourself and stay in touch. And if there's anything we can do ever, please let us know.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
After the break, true crime writers break down the incredible responsibility of the genre. Welcome back to Australian True Crime. Of course, our very own Emily Webb is a crime writer. She's published 3 books so far, Murder in Suburbia, Suburban Nightmare, and Angels of Death. She spoke with our friend Megan Norris, who's joined us in earlier episodes of Australian True Crime, to discuss the fears and responsibilities of taking on the true crime genre.
Journalists who were trained, or writers who were trained to deal with the publication of that kind of information, and professionals, medical professionals like himself, who were trained to treat people not write about them. You know, that his job isn't, he might write reports on them and talk at medical conferences on them, but it's a very different thing to write a book where you explore that kind of sensitivity, I think. Yeah. So we are, through experience, are trained to know what's going to set off buzzers, and we don't always get it right either. But you do know, you do stop, and with something like that, you might want to include those dying words, but the first thing you would do would be to ring the mother to find out if she knew.
And Michelle's done a very good interview with this woman. He was listening to her talk about how she'd had to get through her grief, and then this has reignited it, because she'd often wondered what were her daughter's last words. So it's pretty raw. So Michelle and I thought you and me would just have a bit of a chat about how you approach crime writing, some of the mistakes we've made, but also how you balance out the topic with the sensitivities. To be honest, I'm really questioning whether I republish my books at the moment. I don't know if I'm just going to let them, I might let them slide and start again. Do you know what I mean?
I do know. And it's I've covered murders all my life. And I think from my take, because I'd worked in court, and I was working for a newspaper, I think there was good grounding for me. Because I was working in court, on a newspaper, watching cases unfold, inevitably the survivors of violent crime, the secondary survivors of violent crime, like the families, they feel they need to know everything. Mm. They want to know everything. They don't want to be spared. They want to know everything. It's been out of their control. Everything was out of their control. So their last control is to know everything. They need the knowledge, and they'll decide what they can deal with. They don't like police saying, "Oh, I never told you that," because you wouldn't cope with that.
Mm.
They want to know. And so I would see them on a daily basis as cases were unfolding, and I would see them tormented. I always used to dread the day that the pathologist gave evidence, because the pathologist or the first responders would give evidence about what they saw, but the pathologist would give evidence about the extent of the injuries and all of that sort of thing. In newspapers, we didn't have room to explore all that graphic stuff, and we just didn't either. You give the bones of it. You've only got time to give the bones of it. But I know from sitting in court, observing people, survivors, listening to that kind of information, when they haven't been told, this was my lesson, when they haven't been told everything, they'll hear it anyway.
Yeah.
And people try, the police will say, "Oh, I don't think you should go in and listen to that. Maybe not go today." And they want to, and they have to, and I would want to.
Yeah.
And they go in and they listen to everything, and you see their faces, you see the grief, you see, remember, a court case is usually about 18 months after the event, by the time it gets to trial. And they're crushed, they're devastated, and you see that pain, and they'll say, inevitably, I would go outside after to get a cup of coffee, and they would be crying in a corner with a counsellor trying to calm them down, saying, "But I asked to be told everything, and I obviously wasn't. I wasn't expecting that."
Yeah.
And then you'd get the counsellor or the police saying, "Well, we told you not to go in there." Stuff that. They have a right to go in there. They have a right to know. And so you'd hear that, and I would think, I'm never going to do that. I'm never going to write anything they don't know.
Yeah.
Ever. And so because I learned that by protecting them, you're not protecting them. So when I write things that are sensitive like that, especially dying words and stuff, and that's common. There's a lot of that, people, especially when you rush to the scene and you can't save someone.
Yeah.
And there's this, people, either the body in the boot, that sticks in my mind. The body in the boot. Laura Dugos, the lady who heard Maria, the Maria Corp, Joseph Corp case in Melbourne some years ago. And Maria Corp was abducted and shoved in the body. She was the body in the boot. And she survived. Well, she sort of was alive, but she was on life support, and she died. But her daughter, Laura Dugos, had woken that morning to this sound. She woke up on a sunny morning, and she heard this sound, and she wasn't sure what she was hearing. And it turned out to be her mother's muffled screams in the garage as Tanya Herman tried to strangle and kill her and bundle her into the boot of the car. She didn't realise that's what she'd heard. She spoke a lot about how that haunted her. And I think it reinforced in me that feeling that if you're writing something of a sensitive nature like that, and it's really dark stuff, you have an obligation, I believe, even as a journalist writing that stuff, I would write it by the day, in court as a journalist in a newspaper, but I didn't have room for all that. And I was only writing what they'd already heard, so they knew.
Yeah.
But when you're writing a book and you might unearth stuff they don't know, first thing I do is go back and ring. I came away, after I found out that Robert Farquharson, I was going through all the transcripts long after the case, and this, I went through the transcripts and I found this nugget that said that he'd been mulling over suicide immediately upon leaving his marriage, you know, when the marriage ended.
Yeah.
That this had been a thought that had been formulating in his head for 6 months before he carried it out, or longer. And I knew that Cindy wouldn't know that.
Yeah.
Because she would have told me, and I hadn't heard it in any of the court cases. I hadn't heard it from anyone else. And I found it and I went out, and the transcript people said, "What have you?" I said, "Has anyone seen this?" And they were like, "Thank you. We've been waiting for someone to notice that. That is crucial to this case, and no one has reported it." And I thought, no, because it was in the voir dire. It was in the trial before a trial,
yeah,
deciding what evidence would be heard. So I went back to the office and I rang Cindy. And she was shattered.
Yeah.
Absolutely shattered. And she said, "Oh my God, could anyone have found that out?" I said, "Yes, after the trial, if a journalist had wanted a story for a newspaper, they could have gone through the court records, they could have read this. I found it, they could have found it. And now that the trial's safely over, it could have been run." And she said, "I could have read that in the newspaper. I could have seen that on TV, and I wouldn't have known." And I thought, "I know." And so that, for me, you know, the book I wrote last had seven separate, it's the only book I've done that had seven separate cases.
Yeah.
Seven separate murders, all terribly sad, all terribly sad. But every time I came across anything that to me was like, took my breath away, or it was particularly dark or heartbreaking, I immediately rang the person I was writing about and said, "Can you confirm that you knew this?"
And I think that's the, you know, we talk a lot about this because you've been a mentor for me writing, and I know there's things that I would do differently with my books now that I didn't do 5 years ago. And I guess it's treading that line where there's the information that's out in the public, like court documents, newspaper reports, television reports, and you report that, but you've still got to understand that the victims, you know, family members of victims, it's all very raw. And I know I've shared with you some experiences I've had with, you know, people contacting me and asking why have you written about that? And I guess I think, well, it's all out in the public, and it is, and I would never include anything gratuitous, but it has made me really think about, what I would do now. And I think certainly the ideal situation is to contact absolutely everyone, and we know that's not possible when you're doing books of several cases, but I certainly know that, you know, I have a lot of pause for thought now with writing true crime. I think there's a lot of responsibility.
There is, and I don't think that, you know, when you're researching true crime, because you're looking for a bigger picture when you've got a book, you've got time and you want to write more, you know, you want a bigger picture. In newspapers, magazines, with magazines I'll do 1,000 words. Well, you can't get everything into 1,000 words. And you can't in a short newspaper article when you've got tight deadlines. But with a book, you've got the luxury of having that time to explore and to research further. So you always come, and you want something new. Everybody wants something new. Otherwise, people won't buy it. They'll say, "I've read that already. I knew that."
Yes.
What's new? So you're looking for something new. So when I'm looking for something new, which I am, I'm pretty well guessing, if I haven't read it or heard it anywhere else, it's possible that that person doesn't know.
Yeah.
And so you'd have to have that obligation or that sense of responsibility that you will call those people. And I think that comes from experience as well. Because years ago, the first book I wrote, which I really regret, I think it was actually an article I originally wrote for a magazine, and it was on the Rachel Barber case. And Rachel Barber was the little dancer in Melbourne that was murdered by the family babysitter who lived over the road, a sort of single white female girl who had a bit of an obsession with Rachel.
That's right, and she's now out of jail, isn't she?
Yeah, she's out of jail now. But what happened, I was originally covering, it wasn't the book, it was for the article I wrote when I first met them. And I wrote this article, and what struck me, they gave me all these photos to look at, the Barbers, and on one of the photos was a picture of Rachel holding this big trophy. a dancing trophy, and I noticed the name on it, and the name was Elizabeth Membry. Membry, do you remember the Membry
case? Yes, I do, yes.
And Joy and Roger Membry, her parents, they mounted, it was a heartbreaking case of ambiguous loss. You know, missing, presumed dead.
Yes.
She's never been found. And they were in a very bad place at that time. She hadn't long gone. But it turned out that Elizabeth went to the same school, Elizabeth Membry, went to the same dancing school that Rachel went to. And Rachel won the Elizabeth Membry Memorial Trophy that her parents had done, their family had donated to this dance school that Elizabeth used to go to. And who should win it but Rachel Barber, who then disappeared too.
Mm.
Now, I wasn't suggesting for a single moment that the crimes were connected. They were never connected.
Mm.
There was no suggestion they were ever connected, and I never wrote that. But the fact was, I think I opened the story that I wrote with that connection. Here's this little girl posed with this wonderful trophy donated by the family of a missing Melbourne girl. And by some cruel irony, within a month or so of receiving this trophy, Rachel too disappeared. And it was an ominous, an eerie link. And as the nature of the magazine I was writing for, they look for those sorts of things. That's the sort of story that they run. So I wrote it in fitting with the magazine. But I didn't ring the memories.
Yeah.
Because the story that I was writing was about Rachel Barber. And because it was a fact that this photo had been in the paper of her with this trophy, though no one had made the connection. And it was also a fact that she had gone missing too. And at the time, it was all over the papers that there were searches for Elizabeth Membry going on. They were dredging lakes and all sorts. So it was a timely story. And I didn't ring them because the story I was writing for the Barbers was confidential.
Yeah.
So it's subject to the confidential arrangement with the magazine, so I couldn't have anyway. But I suppose morally, I could have made a quiet phone call and said, will this upset you? But I never thought of that at that time. I was, this was years ago. So the story went to press, and Elizabeth and Mike Barber were very happy with the story, and the members were devastated that I'd drawn this link. I think they misread it and said I was inferring that these cases were linked. And I never was. I was never saying that. I was saying what a dreadful irony is what I was saying.
The people interpret what they want to at the time, which is understandable, but it's sometimes it's you don't plan for that to happen.
You don't, but Mr. Membry rang me and he was in tears. Yeah. And he said, my wife is in the background sobbing. It's brought it all up. And I said, well, with the greatest respect, it is in the newspapers right now, everywhere.
Yeah.
And but they were so distraught. And they said, if only they'd known. And do you know what? I've never forgotten it.
Yes.
I've never forgotten their deep distress. It was a small thing to me. It was a huge thing to them.
Yes, absolutely.
And it was not something I would even have considered. But and even a few years back, and I'm very careful now, you don't realise when you write things, and especially when I write them for magazines or prints, that the timing of them can also be, it might not be a single word you've said, but the timing is what really upsets people. So I wrote a story some years ago, after Darcy Freeman dad was jailed for throwing her off the Westgate Bridge and murdering her, I wrote a story where I looked at other children who'd been murdered by their fathers for a magazine. And the story ran, I never gave it a thought, and it ran almost on the anniversary of the murders of Dione Ferring's children.
Yeah.
And Dione Ferring and I became quite close after that. She featured in my book that was published last year. But at that time, some years ago, she rang and she was so upset. And I learned a lot from that call. She was so upset with me. And I said, what did I say? Did I say something wrong? What did I say that upset you? She said, no, I go into a big black hole every year between April and that day when the children were murdered and Mother's Day. It's like a whole black hole in my life that disappears every year.
Yeah.
And I get sucked into it because I relive the anniversaries of, oh, this was the day the children went on access. This was the day they didn't come back. This was the day they were found. This was the day of their funeral. Then it's Mother's Day. And she relives that first awful Mother's Day, being a mother without children. And the story, by coincidence, was published then. And what happened was the magazine had rung and the court case had ended. So they needed the story now at the end of the court case. So the story had to be timed for the court case. So it was not my fault, you know, the stories had to be told. But what I never thought of doing was to ring the other mothers whose cases I revisited in that story.
Yeah.
And I always would do that now, because Dionne said, you have got no idea what it's like to have, say, two little children, new children, you've moved on, to go to the supermarket, pick up a magazine, and yeah, see your stories staring back at you, and face your children's faces staring back at you on the anniversary of the worst time of your life.
Yeah, I know. It's. I certainly know that writing, if I write another book again, I'm going to be doing it very differently. I know I had an experience where, you know, I wrote my first book, I wrote a series of cases, and some cases I actually spoke to people for them. Others I was, you know, drawing research from court records and newspaper articles and the like. Some were very old cases, but some were newer cases, but I didn't contact the families. And there was a situation where in a promotion article for the book, a photograph was used of a victim's daughter, and it did make it look like she had spoken to me. And that wasn't in my control, because it was the editor of that publication who used that photo. You know, in my discussions with the person, they didn't understand that their photos become property of that newspaper organization, and that can be used time and time again as well. And I feel like that doesn't get explained to people enough. And I think, having worked in the media, there's just ways that we can do things better.
Even with the book that I did last year, Look What You Made Me Do, with that book, I know that whilst one of the mothers was more than happy to talk to me, and the crime, you know, she still went into a big black hole to revisit that part of her life. When I sent her a copy of the manuscript to read her story, because I wanted her to be happy with it and to check to make sure I'd made no mistakes, I sent her a copy of the manuscript, and her son was, do you remember me telling you this?
Yes.
Her son, who's now grown up, but he only by good fortune, because he was a baby, she refused to let him go to a violent ex, because he was such a small baby, but she couldn't stop the ex-husband having access to the toddler, and he murdered the toddler. Had the baby gone, he would have murdered the baby too.
Mm.
And so that boy has grown up with this awful spectre of this murder, you know, this shadow hanging over his life. And he survived when his sister didn't. It must be very, very painful, yes, for him. And she was fine with the story, but he went into meltdown. He found it devastating. He didn't want her to do it. So a lot of people, when they do these stories with you, they really put themselves out there.
They really
with their own
do.
Family.
They do.
You know, with their own family. And so yeah, other people in the family will get very upset because they're not coping, and so they don't want you to do it. So those people then are hypervigilant. So they will read the story looking for something wrong, because basically they're not angry with the story. They're angry that they're having to relive that part of their lives again.
Yeah, and I think they want control over their story as well, don't they? Because I know with a few situations, it's like, The victim is remembered in a certain way because of certain facts that are released to the media, but the family members know that person is more than just what is reported. I know in one of the chapters I wrote, you know, I was going by a lot of court documents, and it was the Burwood triple killings of Ashley Coulston. And at the time when he was caught, it was widely reported that it was security guards who actually tackled him and arrested him, but it in fact was a young policewoman. And I got an email from this policewoman, and I'm hoping to speak to her to update some stuff, but she just, I think after years, had enough of the misreporting, and you know, this,
yeah,
her bravery is incredible. And I felt so bad. I apologized. I said, I'm so sorry. She said, look, it's just, I'm sick of being, yeah, misreported. And she basically had, you know, a gun pointed at her in the middle of her face, and she tackled.
Incredibly brave. Incredible.
I know. So I think I'm desperate to update that.
And you learn, don't you? Because I found that I've got to be truthful, in latter years, it's not a word I've written. You know, because I do cross all my T's and make those phone calls and do make
you
sure
do.
People know. Because I've learned in the past, and most of the problems that I've had in the past have not been to do with books that I've written. It's been to do with news that I've written, because news is immediate and you haven't time to hang around, and you're working under deadline. You've got like an hour to finish the story, and you write it as fast as you can, and you check it, and you make sure it's accurate, and you get it off. But it's those nuances that you or unforeseen things that crop up that upset people. You know, some it might be that is exactly what was said in court, but they say, no, that's not what happened. So I found it, but of later years, I would say that most of the complaints or the upsets that have been caused with things that I've written have been to do with timing.
Yes. Yep.
Not to do with what I've actually said. So even when you are as careful as can be, people have a lot of unresolved stuff when they've lost someone to a violent death. It never goes away. No. I don't like that expression that you get closure. There's no such thing as closure for the victim or survivor of a violent crime. No such thing. And with every year that passes, it magnifies that sense of loss. So I think that while you might think 25 years later things are better, they're not. They're not better. They're worse in many ways. You know, if you've had a child murdered, you've probably run into their friends in the shops with a baby in the pram.
Yes.
And you'll think, that could be my daughter with that baby in the pram, but she's gone. So I have that discussion on a fairly regular basis. You never get over that. But I do, I'm having to now be much more aware of when things come out.
Yeah.
So after Dione ringing me, and Dione's the most lovely woman, it really made me stop and think. I did a story once on the most dreadful stalking case I'd ever done. And in the end, the young woman who was stalked for years and years, she had several breakdowns and she ended up getting breast cancer and dying.
Oh.
And I, at one stage, wrote a story revisiting stalkers. I was unaware she'd passed away.
Yeah.
And this was an old, old case. And I wrote the story, and it unearthed so much pain for the family. I wrote a story on someone else, and I did a revisit of several terrible cases I'd covered where people had been systematically stalked. And the mother of the girl that passed away rang me, and she was distraught.
Yeah.
And she said, "You are aware she's passed away 2 years ago," and I wasn't. And she said, "Well, she has." And reading this, but the thing for her was, does it mean I can go to the shops in 5 years from now and still see a photo of my daughter pop up in a stalking story?
Yeah.
And it's that out there in the ether stuff, you know, that you just described. Does that mean I've got no control? I can just go to the shops, pick up a magazine, and there will be a story with her picture. I said, I'm afraid so.
Thank you for downloading our Australian True Crime podcast. If you have an Australian true crime story of your own you'd like to share with us, let us know on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. We'd also love it if you'd give us a nice review on iTunes and 5 stars. We'll be back with more Australian true crime next week. Until then, stay safe.